coming up on this episode of Inside Pop.
From Captain Kirk and Uhura kissing to the new film Widows, interracial relationships have been depicted on TV for decades. But what do those depictions say about our society?
We discuss how these relationships have been viewed, criticized, and celebrated through the decades with special guest Lori Tharps.
All of that, and but of course the big sell, it's happening right now on Inside Pop. So, if race is this country's most challenging, most deeply embedded dysfunction, then a look at how we depict race relations in our entertainment can truly illuminate how we deal with the issue. And perhaps even more illuminating than TV shows and movies about racial intolerance are the works that depict the coming together of races, both romantic and familial.
On this episode, we're going to discuss the depiction of interracial relationships in film and television. And joining us for this discussion is Lori Tharps, Associate Professor of Journalism at Temple University, author of the books Hair Story, Untangling the Roots of Black Hair in America, and Insane Family, Different Colors, and the founder and chief content creator for the blog My American Melting Pot. Welcome, Lori.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So, Lori, we are so excited to have you on the podcast. It was great meeting you at Podcast Movement earlier this year. Can you tell us a little bit about your career?
Sure. And it was great meeting you guys, too. Because actually, you guys are kind of my career. You're talking about pop culture and you have a multicultural background as two hosts. So that's kind of what I've always been interested in. So I kind of always knew I wanted to be a writer, was afraid of actually admitting that for a long time. And it wasn't until I was, after graduating from college, I actually took a job in PR in New York City, thinking that was more secure. I would make more money than actually going into, journalism, which is what I wanted to do. I really disliked my career in PR, and so went to get a master's degree in journalism. And I was in New York City. I went to Columbia University School of Journalism, and I got a job. My first job before graduation was at Vibe magazine. And anybody who knows me or knew me then knew that I know very, very little about music, particularly hip hop. And I was working at Vibe at the like height of Vibe's, you know, glory. And it was an amazing experience. But when they hired me, I was hired as a fact checker. And I told the chief of reporters at the time, I was like, look, I'm really good. I know I can do this job. Just don't ever assign me any stories about music. Yes, this is a music magazine. I was like, I will do political stories. I will do the beauty. I'll do culture. Just don't expect me to do music. Like, put me on everything else. And he took a chance on me. This was, you know, really sad because that man, Dave Breed, recently passed away from cancer. But I really attribute my start to him because he did take a chance on me. And Vibe literally changed my life. I feel like I became the writer and journalist like who understood that you could write about people of color, that people of color were often the ones, you know, creating our popular culture. And it was so exciting to work with other people of color. It was the first time that I had been surrounded by, you know, in a professional workspace by people who looked like me because I'm from Wisconsin. So after Vibe, I worked at Entertainment Weekly magazine, and that was, again, it was a freelance position that I started there. And very soon after I got there, Frank Sinatra died. And I was responsible for, like, fact-checking the Frank Sinatra discography, which if anybody knows how many songs Frank Sinatra sang or wrote, it was so many that I practically slept at the Entertainment Weekly offices. And apparently I proved my dedication because they offered me like a full-time job very soon after his death. So even though I've never been a Frank Sinatra fan, after that, I was like, I love Frank Sinatra. He gave me the chance to prove my worth. And so I started at Entertainment Weekly and worked there for about 4 years. And again, always was able to, even though Entertainment Weekly is a very obviously mainstream magazine, I was really able to, again, bring my desires and interests in, I'd say, ethnicity, race, and identity to the stories I did. I remember, again, hair, I remember writing a story about Justin Timberlake wearing cornrows. This was in the 90s, so I'm dating myself a little bit. But yeah, so that's kind of where my like start in the, you know, covering pop culture. And when I had a started having children, not like I have so many of them, but when I became a mom, you know, working at Entertainment Weekly became difficult because it required a lot of, you know, being out and about, and I couldn't marry that with having a small child. So I started freelancing then and worked for multiple more lifestyle magazines, continuously doing, you know, kind of pop culture trends. And at the same time, I was writing books. So that hair thing that I told you that I was obsessed with, I wrote a book called Hair Story, Untangling the Roots of Black Hair in America, which is a chronological history of Black people and their hair in pop culture. And, you know, I wrote some other books as well. And, you know, I've just continued to try to write about pop culture and kind of race and ethnicity and identity. And that's why I started my blog, My American Melting Pot. I actually started that blog 12 years ago because I wanted a place to be able to write about things like, you know, how, again, like different cultures coming together or clashing impact popular culture. And so many times mainstream media outlets aren't interested in, you know, thinking about interracial relationships or thinking about how come everybody's eating Korean tacos. You know, I want to kind of dig into those trends that showcase how this country is so impacted by our different ethnic groups, and particularly when they come together.
I think it's so interesting because the history that you described from working at a music magazine without knowing or wanting or, you know, having a huge interest in music to your time at Entertainment Weekly. I always assume that entertainment journalists, quite often you'll have to write about things that you don't have a great interest in, but it's your job, like Frank Sinatra. I'm going to bring you to Frank Sinatra trivia night someday as a ringer. but it seems like as you describe it and as you're kind of finding your way through your career, it was all giving you experience leading up to what you're doing now and what you seem to have a real passion for.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I always tell, so I teach now, I teach journalism at Temple University in Philadelphia. And I always tell my students that, you know, my career is literally steps to where I am now. And I didn't expect to end up in academia. I didn't expect to necessarily be writing. I've written 5 books now, and I didn't think that, you know, that that's where my career would go. But all of the books I've written are really examples of exactly what I'm passionate about. And they don't seem, you know, I have my memoirs called Kinky Gazpacho, and it's about, you know, being Black in Spain. And the book was rejected several times because the editors at the different publishing houses would say, you know, this sounds interesting, but I just don't know if there anybody cares about Black people, or they don't care about Spain. You know, if this was about France, sure, we would love that. Or maybe it's Italy. If it was Italy, I mean, everybody loves a good story about Italy.
My gosh.
But there was one editor at Simon & Schuster who thought it was great. And, you know, thank you to her. It was published. I understand now, you know, how to tell a good story. And I understand that oftentimes the, like, really interesting stories about popular culture are not told because the right people aren't in charge of, you know, green lighting these stories being told, whether that's books, whether that's TV shows, whether that's movies. So I feel like somebody's got to do it. It might as well be me.
Well, we want to talk about something that doesn't get covered quite often. We want to talk about interracial relationships as they're depicted on TV and film. And I mean, there have been articles and people have talked about talked about it, but I'm excited for us to talk to you to kind of go deeper than I think I've heard a lot of conversations about this. Do you see any trends in the current state of how interracial relationships are depicted in TV and film today?
Yeah, I mean, I've been thinking about this a lot because this is something as a person who is, my husband is from Spain, so we are an interracial family ourselves. And so, you know, when you are part of, when this is your life, you're always looking for reflections of your life in popular culture. And so I'm constantly looking for that, you know, whether it's for my children to show them films where they'll see families that look like theirs, or just for myself. So again, I've been, you know, like kind of keeping track of this trend for, you know, forever of my adult life, I should say. So, I think like we're seeing a real like proliferation of interracial relationships right now, which is, really exciting, because there used to be maybe one interracial family, or interracial couple, in movies or on television. And now, you know, there's, at least a dozen that you can think of between television and movies. So I think one trend is that Hollywood is becoming more comfortable portraying interracial families. And also the other trend is that not only that they're, you see more of them, that you see more of them without explanation. It used to be if there was an interracial family, it was the point of the story. Mm-hmm. I remember, you know, Mississippi Masala, it's even in the title, you know, it's like, there's some interracial romance here, or that great movie, Something New. It was like the new thing was that she was going to date a white man. Mm-hmm. So like it was, that's the focus of the story. Now it's just, oh, there's a new sitcom on, and one of the couples has to be an interracial couple. So I think that's what's like trending right now is I feel like entertainment execs are, they have to be aware. I mean, this is not something that just happens. I mean, they think all of these decisions are made very consciously, but they're doing it in a way that appears to be coincidental, that this couple might be interracial. This family is, we're casting an interracial family.
How do you feel about culture differences, racial issues or problems being mentioned in a sitcom? Like, do you have a need to see that? Or how do you feel if it's never addressed?
See, that was going to be the other side of the coin, because that is the trend that I see absolutely is, I think, positive to not have to make it the plot point. But then I believe it's a little bit disingenuous not to mention it, right?
Yeah.
Like, especially any sitcom that's taking place in 2018 in America.
Right.
Like, I don't think you have to overdo it, but I think ignoring it, which seems to be the fault of what's happening now. And again, I don't want to fault, like, I can already hear somebody saying, can't they ever be happy? They put some interracial relationships up there and they're still going to complain. Master of None, I kind of got mad because it's like, yeah, we saw his family, but he was always with somebody white. Or there just weren't any. And I think there was like a half a second in one episode where he considered dating an Indian woman.
Yeah. He went on a bunch. It was, I think it was called First Date, and he went a bunch of dates. And there was a couple of Indian women in there, and it became a little bit like humorous because they joked about dating and their culture a little bit, but it was like a minute of the show. Yeah.
Right. So I don't know, maybe he thought too much brownness on the screen would make people not want to watch, but he did a good job of bringing in his family and cousins. So you definitely got that. I don't really have beef with him for not being like ethnically correct, if you will.
Right.
But but in terms of the interracial relationships, that could have been, I guess he was having them all the time. So
it's really hard for me to think, just to again speak for the Indian Americans in the house. It's hard because I follow my peeps, and it is very rare to see two Indian Americans together. It's mostly interracial. Mindy Project.
Do you mean on TV on TV?
On TV.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mindy Project she was always with, you know, predominantly white guys.
Yeah.
Master of None, you know, season two was, yeah, you know, his infatuation with a woman from Italy. I feel bad, you know, even Quantico, like I can't, let me name more shows, guys.
Mississippi Masala, let's take it all the way back.
Right. Let's take it to the film. Lion was a recent example. You know, yeah. You've got Slumdog Millionaire, which is based in India. You know, like, I think there is, like, if you're talking about things that are depicted in film and television here in America, it is hard for me to really think of a relationship that is not interracial when it comes to Indian Americans.
Yeah, it is interesting how, especially in 2018, in this like extreme wokeness time, a black and white couple, for example, from a good number of people would not be considered the ideal, right? Like the ideal would still be like, I know I want to see two black people together, right? That's it. Mm-hmm. Maybe you're mm-hmm. a little bit of a sellout mm-hmm. if you're with someone who is an African American. Whereas I think for Indian Americans, you know, one thing might be, again, we talked about this before, a lot of these creators are writing from their own experience. So Mindy is possibly writing about her own experience. Mm-hmm. Ditto Aziz Ansari. And I think that mm-hmm. like there are a lot of immigrant cultures who cherish their culture, will marry people from their own culture. But there, I think there is also something about that assimilation and embracing being an American. And part of that is, yeah, and you have the option to date a white person, date a white American. And that might be one thing that's happening with all of these interracial romances with Indian Americans.
Maybe, yeah. And I think to go back to what you're saying, I think, you know, black love is a hashtag right now, right? I think that is sort of a backlash to want to see, you know, not an interracial relationship. It's a storyline under your white people, right? It's interesting. I do think there is a little bit of a backlash. You know, we celebrate how amazing it is to see wonderful, healthy black relationships on Queen Sugar on this show.
Throughout my childhood in the 80s, even in the 90s, if you are an interracial couple, like if you saw a black actor and a white actress or anything like that, then you knew that they weren't going to be able to actually be attracted to each other. Like there would be all this on-screen chemistry and they'd get a handshake at the end, right? It made no sense.
What was the name of that couple on the Jeffersons?
The Willises.
You had Roxy Roker, Lenny mm-hmm. Kravitz's mom.
Right.
And Tom and Helen. That's what their names
yes.
are.
Yes.
The entertainment industry was always behind, I think, of what reality was in terms of where we were as a culture to in terms of interracial relationships. But there were those early couples like Tom and Helen on the Jeffersons. Mm-hmm. But then it like kind of scarce after that. We didn't get very much more. And Tom mm-hmm. and Helen, and I love them. I love everything about the Jeffersons. The Jeffersons was such a forward-thinking show. I mean, George Jefferson was like a black man with an attitude who called white people honkies to their faces. Right. Like we haven't had a character like that since. But the idea that you could have interracial romance was so foreign. It was so like unheard of in popular culture on our screen that the idea of even pairing like two, I remember, I don't know what movie this was with Arnold Schwarzenegger and Vanessa Williams. And she's so beautiful and he was still in his prime at that time. And it was like, if she had been white, they would have exchanged some bodily fluids, okay?
Right.
They would have been some stuff. And it was like, kiss her already. And no,
yeah.
I remember watching that movie and just being like, he was like, good job.
Yeah. And then Lori, an even more extreme example is, how do you cast Denzel Washington and Julia Roberts, the two most attractive, biggest stars of whatever year that movie came out, in the Pelican Brief, and not allow them kiss? I think they hugged at the end. You're not Julia Roberts, and you spend 2 hours of Denzel saving your life without kissing him at the end of the movie. That doesn't happen. But it happened.
It doesn't happen, but you don't let a black man kiss America's sweetheart.
No, you do
and
not.
And I think if you think about it, like a lot of our a lot of our interracial relationships that we see on screen, if you think about it, it is the black woman or the woman of color with a white man, mm-hmm. always. And think mm-hmm. about historically why that's okay.
Right.
You know,
right.
because the white man can dominate the woman of color.
Yeah.
And we have. You want to unpack that?
No. I want to hear you unpack that, because I was going to say that it would be interesting to talk about Will Smith, one of the biggest movie stars in the past 20 years, and who his romantic leads have been. And I'm trying to think if he's ever had a, not that I need him to have a white woman as a romantic lead, but I don't think that's ever happened. Eva Mendes was his romantic lead.
Yeah, Eva Mendes. And then in
Rosario Dawson.
Right, but wasn't she dying in that movie? Like, did they ever actually have?
Yeah, they did. Okay. They did. Yeah. I think actually I remember reading somewhere that might have been one of his first love scenes.
Okay.
Well, and they're both Latina.
Right.
And right. then.
Yes.
And then you have. He was in, what is the movie? He played a big, like a curmudgeonly superhero in Opposite Charlie's Theron. Yeah.
Yeah.
And they were deeply in love, but they showed their love by killing each other.
Yeah.
I don't recall them actually.
I don't either.
Being, which is, again, it's like, how do we do this so that they don't actually touch, but we still show like chemistry mm-hmm. by killing each other.
Right. Oh. I'd love for you to go back to what you were talking about how it's safer in a way okay. for a black woman to be with a white man.
Exactly. So there's so many different issues involved in interracial relationships that are real and play out in our day-to-day life. But to like simplify it, you know, historically, you know, black men were lynched for even, I don't know, I want to say looking at a white woman, but they didn't even have to be looking at them. Mm-hmm. But the whole idea of creating this concept of the black boogeyman who would go after white women is kind of what this country's racial violence and fear was built on, the fear of the black man defiling the white woman. Mm-hmm. And that was done, I mean, deliberately and intentionally to make the black man completely powerless in society, because everybody would fear him. And so that trope, that idea has followed black men throughout history in this country. And like I said before, the entertainment industry really isn't in it to, you know, make the world a better place. They're in it to make money. They're in it to get audiences. And they are, the industry as a whole are followers. That's why you have independent films that we look to actually break through the status quo, because the mainstream entertainment industry doesn't want to challenge anyone's assumptions because then they might not bring their dollars to the Cineplex, right? Mm-hmm. So I think that there are still far too many people who would look at a black man and a white woman together as like against God, right. as violence inducing. Then you're not going to see it. No industry executive is going to take that risk. And just as an example, you know, in 2013, we're talking just 5 years ago, Cheerios, you know, General Mills had the audacity to make a commercial where it was an interracial family, a black man, a white mom, and a little biracial girl. The black man and the white mom, the father and the mother, were never even in the room together in this, I don't know, 30-second commercial. And I'll just call them the racists. The racists came out of the woodwork to protest that commercial with such virulent hatred.
They, I remember that.
They were disgusting. They said that they almost threw up when they saw it. And it being what? a man with Cheerios on his chest. I mean, they literally, the wife and the husband were never even in the room together. Mm-hmm. And people were so offended. They were offended that they had to see this, that Cheerios had to, you know, take the comments off the YouTube channel for that commercial, because they were just inundated with hate mail, hate comments, hateful comments. And imagine that was 30 seconds of a Cheerios ad. How could you do a movie or a sitcom where people would have to see that every day? That being a black man and a white woman. So on the other hand, we know that black women, women of color, Native women have always been the sexual playthings of white men historically. And white men have always felt it is their right to abuse and use the bodies of women of color. And so therefore, as a culture, we are accepting of this. We white women have turned a blind eye to their white husbands, you know, raping the slaves, or having a concubine. As we go through history, you know, that's what we understood. And not to say that any interracial couple with a black woman and a white man today, that people are like, oh, that's the whore. It's not like that. But we have been conditioned to accept these relationships between women and white men as normal, as part of our cultural history. It's something we're used to. We have been used to it. We have been bred mm-hmm. to believe that this is normal. This is okay. There's no threat there. So if the entertainment industry is going to test the waters with the interracial relationship, they're going to find a, you know, a willing woman of color and a white man and see if it's going to work. And that's called The Bodyguard. Whitney Houston, Kevin Costner. How's that?
Yes.
It was really great. Made somebody a whole lot of money and made the entertainment industry recognize, okay, we can do this. But the entertainment industry, they are not leaders, they are followers. So if it worked with Whitney and Kevin, we could do next level, Sanaa Lathan and, please forgive me, the white man with the curly hair who was her love interest in Something New. Cute as can be.
Patrick
I forget
Wilson.
His name.
Patrick Wilson.
Oh, yes.
You know, and we'll keep on trying that. Right. And now, you know, pull us up to 2013, we can substitute Indian women for black women and mm-hmm. also give them white male interests. And, you
and
know.
Latino women and, you know.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's okay because, again, Latino women, we know what they were good for. We know where they're historically, we have seen them and what roles. And Indian women, it's different. I feel like people assume they're brown women, they're okay to be with white women, with white men, right? Like, the public will accept that. Mm-hmm. The public mm-hmm. won't challenge that. So in that, if you look at history that way, then what Aziz Ansari is doing is actually quite subversive and pretty, you know, even if he was like, in real life, white women disgust me. But the fact that he's getting with them, it's like sticking it to the man. Like, I'm a brown Indian man, and I'm going to take your women on front time, right?
Deal with
like,
it.
Like, what are you going to do about it? And you're going to give me an Emmy for it.
That's right.
Yeah, because I think Aziz Ansari had been criticized for only dating white women on the show, and that translates into only giving parts, acting parts to white women. I really love that point, Lori, about how there is something progressive about it. I think about the show Black-ish, which I think does very interesting things in its depiction of interracial relationships because of the character Rainbow being biracial. But even then, you've made me realize that she's biracial because of her biracial mother but white father. So again, even on Black-ish, and it's not a critique, but it's an observation that you're helping me make, that it's still a white man with a black woman or a biracial woman.
I'm trying to think, like, I'm trying to come up with an example. Oh, there we go. Of a where we actually see a black man with a white woman. And the most recent example that's on my list is Get Out. And we know how that ended.
Oh. spoiler alert, it didn't end well.
That is the most
well.
Recent example.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not giving away details if you haven't seen it yet. But right.
But it does not end well.
But think about that. There's just not a whole lot. And again, I feel like there are many, you know, in real life, there are many black women who still find it problematic to see a black man with a white woman. It feels like very betrayal. It feels very personal rejection mm-hmm. when, mm-hmm. And I know that's true also with a lot of Indian women about that always with the white girl, like, why can't he be with another Indian woman? Mm-hmm. And these are what people feel, like these are personal feelings. But to see it on screen, you know, it is, on the one hand, you can see it as aggressive. If we saw a black man with a white woman on television, or on the movie theater, but like Get Out kind of takes that, you know, it's that every black woman can say, I told you not to do that. Like, I told you not to go there, which basically goes back to our, you know, the black men dating white women is just dangerous. It's just not going to end well. And when we say not well, we could mean like, you know, your brain taken out your head.
You know what? The only example I can think of, and I think it's an interesting example, is on Marvel's Luke Cage and Marvel's Jessica Jones, the characters played by Mike Coulter, and who's Luke Cage, and Jessica Jones, who's played by Kristen Ritter. Is that her name? They have, and it's a very, 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 actually, I'm not going to say graphic, but it's a very intense sex scene. So for maybe half a season, those two are together, and you actually see them kiss, and you see them having mm-hmm. sex in a relatively, again, the graphic's not the word, but in I think in an authentic, real, passionate way. And I think that's especially powerful because Mike Coulter is a very, very dark-skinned man. Kristen Ritter, very, very, very fair-skinned. And so I think that even punctuates it even more when you look at the hues, right? It's like there is no denying Mike Coulter mm-hmm. is African-American. He is black. And Kristen Ritter is white. No doubt about it. And even just like that visual of seeing those two skin tones, a challenge for the cinematographer, coming together on screen like that. Interesting. And, you know, maybe Netflix can do that because it's Netflix and they are all powerful. They're running our lives. But they don't have to worry about advertiser dollars. I don't think they even have to worry about subscribers getting pissed off and leaving because they just have millions and millions of them. So, yes, it was a superhero show, but also something I think it feels revolutionary now in this discussion. Undeniable sexual chemistry, sexual action between those two characters.
Yeah, I have watched a few Luke Cage episodes, and I did see that episode, and I remember being like, oh.
Yeah.
Like, they're actually going to show us this? Mm-hmm. Like, uh-huh. Because I'm so used to, we were not going to actually be privy to that. And Sean, I had the same idea that, well, of course, Netflix can do that. Mm-hmm. And that's what we're kind of, that's where I was saying before that you have to leave it to independent filmmakers to explore, you know, interracial relationships in a more authentic way and beyond the comfort of the brown woman and the white man. Mm-hmm. And like you said, Netflix doesn't have to worry about advertisers pulling their dollars from the show. So they can pretty much do what they want. And, you know, you see that in a lot of the shows that they have. I mean, Sense8, which is another series that has a lot of amazing sex scenes that just are between people of I mean, different people, different ethnic, there were some orgies in there with people of all different ethnic backgrounds. I mean, I wouldn't say orgy, but I'd say multiple people all at the same time.
Oh, no, we've discussed those scenes. Yeah. Sean definitely classifies it as an orgy. It's one of his favorite shows.
Lori, where have you been all of my life? I have no one to talk to about this show.
Right? Oh, my God. I'm like, this sounds terrible, but I've never enjoyed watching two men having sex. Like, I mean, that show, I was like, whoa. That was so beautiful.
Yeah, I mean, and actually the core of that show is all about inter-everything, intercultural, interracial, intergender relationships. Right. And yeah, again, it's Netflix.
They went all the way. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. Yeah, you know, you made me think of another Netflix series that does the same thing. You're getting to something, I think, Lori, about Netflix taking those chances, I guess. I don't think it's a chance, but, you know, they're actually doing it, well, you know.
That's exactly the thing, is that you have to be free from corporate barriers to explore reality. And it's just so foolish, because what did you say, Sean, that Netflix owns the world, that Netflix, you know, has millions of subscribers? Mm-hmm. Are they losing out by pushing the envelope? And again, when we say pushing the envelope, like, this is the life everybody's leading anyway.
Right.
It's not like Black men aren't marrying white women. It's not like white women aren't marrying men of color and of every ethnic background. So they're simply reflecting real life. And we all know that real life is far more fascinating than anything manufactured for a sitcom on NBC.
Right.
And I do think that, you know, another thing that I was noticing just as looking at this as a trend is that a lot of these interracial relationships are being portrayed in products aimed at the young adult market. So, you know, The Hate U Give, which everybody is portraying as the, you know, like the Black Lives Matter movie or the Black Lives Matter book or the book about police brutality, also has a very strong interracial relationship in it that I thought Angie Thomas, I have not seen the film, but have read the book. I thought Angie Thomas did a really good job of exploring what a teenage interracial relationship entails. It wasn't just, oh, my white boyfriend. Like, she really got into like the kind of struggles that a Black girl has who wants to be authentically Black, but totally thinks this white boy is cute.
Mm-hmm,
It's not simple. And she really, like, I thought did a really good job of exploring those issues more so than most other like YA fiction does. Like, she went to the places where a teenage romance would go with those kinds of issues. It wasn't two-dimensional. It wasn't thrown in for shock appeal. And I really appreciated the fact that she didn't make them break up. Like, she didn't say, well, in order to be Black, I'm going to have to, like, at the end, she finds her voice, but she didn't have to give up the boyfriend. She still found a way to do that. And there's the other movie and book, Everything is Everything, which also has same actress, ironically, Amanda, how do you pronounce her last name? Sternberg.
I think it's Amanda Steinberg or Sternberg. Yeah.
So she's in that movie, plays a girl who, the movie and the book, she's a girl who's suffering from a immune disorder and has had to stay inside for most of her life and falls in love with a white boy. And again, it's not like, that's not even an issue. Like, that's not even brought up. So we're seeing, the younger generation is already being given these relationships without apology, without making it a big deal, so to speak, or doing it in a way that's really way more authentic. So it seems to be either, you know, the independent producers, meaning like the Netflix or independent movie makers, and or the products that are made for a younger generation that is a lot more comfortable with this concept of, you know, dating and mating and family making across color lines. Oh, even A Wrinkle in Time, Ava DuVernay's Wrinkle in Time, the parents were interracial, but also then the little love between, now that's, the book was already written, But the fact that Ava casted it across racial lines, mm-hmm. both the parents and the kids, mm. also, without like, there was no like, but mommy's black or your boyfriend's yeah. white. Yeah. What are you doing? It just was with no explanation. That wasn't right. necessary. So I think we have, again, an independent creative class that's completely not even like exploring these issues. Like Sense8, they're not exploring interracial relationships. They're just using the sexiest people with each other to make a great film.
Yeah.
I mean, a great series. Mm-hmm. And Ava DuVernay looked like she picked great actors. She didn't say, let's really make something crazy here, right? Mm-hmm. She just picked the actors that she wanted. The one for Everything is Everything, same thing. And Angie Thomas, when she wrote The Hate U Give, I feel like she made that story. Like if the little girl goes to a school with all white people, there's a big chance she's going to have a white boyfriend. Mm-hmm. End of story. Yep. Rather yeah. than make it, she doesn't have to be a wallflower. She doesn't have to be like ugly and no white boy would ever want her. Of course, she's popular. She has friends. Why wouldn't she have a boyfriend at the white school?
Right.
So I just feel like younger people are much more able to incorporate these ideas and, you know, interracial relationships and friendships. And we're going to keep it moving. And again, people who aren't afraid of advertisers who tend to be corporations run by old white people can also say, push the envelope, show the world what reflect the world as it is instead of what we want it to look like, what it looked like 20, 30 years ago.
And definitely. Well said.
And I think with that also comes the more and the increased number of depictions of people of color on TV gives us the options of dealing with them in different ways, right? You have a show called Dear mm-hmm. White People, which essentially every conversation on that show, which I love, is about race. So the interracial relationship on that show, which I rooted for so hard, and it was great because I was like, should I be rooting for this relationship or do I want her to like, oh, you know, quote unquote, wake up and, you know, start dating the black guy? But I think you can have interracial relationships, and race is discussed all the time. You can have interracial relationships where it pops up every once in a while. And then you can even have your easy breezy network sitcoms where it doesn't get mentioned, and that's representing a reality for some as well. So I agree with you that we're moving towards more authentic depictions. And I think that also it just comes with the fact that there are more opportunities for those depictions.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I mean, I just looking at some statistics last night that we have, as of 2015, 17% of all new marriages were, marriages across color or racial or ethnic lines. So, I mean, the depictions are reflecting what's out there in the world. And again, I think it definitely is, a sign of progress that interracial relationships aren't simply black and white either anymore. I mean, I think mm-hmm. that's actually pretty impressive. And we know that, we know that actually most marriages in, the Asian community and Asian American community are actually interracial. And so that is the reality that should be reflected. And that's what people are going to recognize as the family next door, my friends, myself, and that's what you want your popular culture to do, is to reflect reality.
Yeah. And I think the fact that we had so many examples to give means that we're moving in the right direction instead of the wrong. Right.
Yeah.
And that we're getting it. And we're taking more steps towards showing these relationships and not, like you said, at the beginning of this, not making it the issue that they are an interracial right. relationship.
I think the question I have still, though, is, you know, so that Cheerios commercial came out 5 years ago. I live in such a bubble. I literally live in one of the most diverse neighborhoods in the United States, in my little bubble in Philadelphia. And again, I see these relationships on TV. I'm seeing these relationships in movies. Even commercials now, like post Cheerios commercials, I swear, like every other Verizon commercial has an interracial family in it, you know? So where are those people who were like going to throw up at the Cheerios commercial? Like, where is this? Like, if they're seeing it on television, are they boycotting those shows? Are they boycotting the Kardashians? And are they an interracial relationship? Like, that's something, like, their whole family is just all loving across the color lines. But, like, that's the most popular show. I mean, they're quadrillionaires because real people want to see real people in these relationships. Or that, I don't know if it matters, if it doesn't matter, if that's part of the draw. I'm not a keeper-upper with the Kardashians, but if interracial relationships were still a problem, how could they be the most popular TV show, a reality show? Like, I don't hear people criticizing, but again, I guess I wouldn't be listening, but still, the idea that this is even problematic anymore is kind of laughable when you think about who is, you know, standing in for, I mean, I almost cried when I saw that somebody wanted to consider that the Kardashians should be our first family, right? Instead of the Obamas. But in terms of the family that rakes in the most money and dominates so much of popular culture, but look at them. They are five whitish women married to people of color, and their brother is too, or at least he procreated with a black woman. So again, it's kind of like, have we turned the page on where people are no longer offended by interracial relationships like they were in just 5 years ago? Or are we just not hearing from them? And are they busy being mad about other things? You know, maybe they're just have.
I mean, in this climate, about, maybe. Right?
But I think the most ironic interracial relationship that just kills me, and this is where I think, like, how could this even be a problem anymore? Is that the Speaker of the House?
Is that Mitch McConnell?
Yeah, Mitch McConnell is married to a Chinese woman. Right. I mean, like, there are so many people across the spectrum in our society who are in interracial relationships. It befuddles me that people would actually still have an issue with this, like, on their screens.
Yeah, yeah. She's Asian, not black, though. I mean, that would never happen in Mitch McConnell's life, but.
Well, and, you know, I mean, and again, I shouldn't, I mean, I'm speaking facetiously because I, to act like people who have racial, like, problems with interracial relationships are not, you know, we're not thinking the same way. But it does seem that our society is pushing really forward with the amount of interracial relationships you see, both in reality. I mean, these numbers, you know, 17% of, you know, new marriages, 1 in 10 people are involved in interracial relationships. So it's like, where would the problem be for pop culture to reflect that in our movies and our television and our commercials, et cetera, and our books? That being said, we do still have, you know, the idea, like as we said, the men of color with a white woman, not so much. We still don't see that. So that's still a bit of a challenge. But I do think, like, overall, the entertainment industry is catching up with where reality truly is.
I agree. I definitely agree. And I really appreciate this conversation about it, because I think it's important to still bring up the topic, to go through the history and to really kind of dissect it, which is what you did so beautifully. And realize that we have come far, but there are still some holes in that fabric, and that there's still some work to be done, but celebrate the fact that we have come pretty far.
Yes, absolutely. And I think it's really, really important for young people in an interracial family to see, like, that's, you know, pop culture should reflect and mirror our lives. And it should be windows. What is it? Windows and mirrors, right? It should be a mirror reflection of your own life to validate your existence, but also windows into a world that's not what you are a part of. Mm-hmm. And so for all the people who aren't, you know, familiar with people who are in an interracial relationship, they can see that it's just like theirs. And for people like my children who want to see their lives reflected on a screen or in a book, there's multiple ways that I can show them that now. And that's really important too.
Definitely.
Don't show your children Sense8 though. I would recommend waiting 15 years. Lori, Thank you so much. This was a really, truly wonderful conversation. We really appreciate you sharing your insight and your experiences with us. It's been a complete pleasure having you on the show.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me. I enjoyed this conversation very much.
Can you tell everyone else how to find your wisdom on social media?
Absolutely. So everybody can read more conversations, read about topics like this conversation on my blog, myamericanmeltingpot.com. Also, I am on the social media bandwagon like everyone else. You can tweet me at Ms. Melting Pot. And I'm on Instagram at My American Melting Pot and Pinterest as well at My American Melting Pot, where I'm always just trying to keep the world a little more colorful.
And you have an announcement.
Yes, I do. Amita, thank you for asking, because on Black Friday of this year, that's Friday, November 23rd, I am going to be launching the My American Melting Pot podcast, where we will be having conversations about pop culture, parenting, and identity politics from a multicultural perspective. And this conversation we just had will be a perfect melting pot conversation. So that's the kind of conversations we'll be having. A little preview, our Black Friday launch episode, we're going to be deconstructing Thanksgiving. So after you've enjoyed your meal, tune in on Black Friday and we'll deconstruct what actually went down during the real Thanksgiving, and how the idea of Thanksgiving is such a kind of multicultural idea, and how people can kind of incorporate their own ethnicity and cultural habits into Thanksgiving in the future.
Oh my gosh, I'm so excited to listen to that. That's awesome. Congratulations also.
Thank you.
We will promote and support that. That sounds like an amazing podcast. We're going to put all of your links in our show notes. So check our show notes for all the links to Lori's life on the internet. And Lori, thank you once again. This has been such a pleasure having you on.
Thank you so much.
And we'll be back with the Big Sell after these short messages.
In a world dominated by dude bro movie podcasts. A world where Casey Affleck has an Oscar and Angela Bassett does not. Only one podcast is brave enough to call bullshit. Who shot ya? With Ricky Carmona.
A lot of people don't know Porgs, Puerto Rican.
Alonzo Duralde.
I would eat Oakjaw.
April Wolf.
I want to interrupt and say that the fish man was real sexy.
Drea Clark.
I have a real soft spot for King Kong.
And women of color.
I was like, damn!
Right, Kugler got final cut.
Kugler got final cut?
I just felt like the film was so sour and so completely irrelevant to basically anything in life.
Who shot ya? Listen every Friday on Maximum Fun or wherever you get your podcasts.
Are stacks of unread books taking over your apartment?
Do you constantly miss your train stop because you're caught up in reading?
I'm Bria Grant.
And I'm Mallory O'Mara.
We party hard.
And by party hard, we mean read books.
So join us every Thursday on Reading Glasses, a Maximum Fun podcast about reading and book culture.
Get more out of your reading life.
We'll help you conquer your to-be-read pile.
Get out of that book slump.
And squeeze more reading time into your busy day.
Learn how to read better.
Wow, that was good.
Welcome back to Inside Pop.
It is now time for The Big Sell. Of course, it's the segment in which Amita and I take turns recommending something from the world of pop culture to the other. And then in the next episode, that other returns and gives a rating and review. Last week, I was, shall we say, effusive about the new Jose James album, and especially one particular song on that album, and I big sold that to Amita. And I'm quite interested to hear, Amita, what you thought about Jose James and his new Bill Withers tribute.
I really enjoyed this covers album. I listened to the whole album because I love Bill Withers, and he has... Just this one album has so many great songs on it. Lean on Me and
just the two of us and, you know, sunshine. And I will say, I love that you suggested Hope She'll Be Happier, because I wasn't familiar with that song. And I thought that was a beautiful, beautiful song. I didn't go back to listen to the original, and I wish I had, just to kind of to give a bit more broad, you know, comparison. But, you know, sometimes it's okay not to compare. And you mentioned that one note in around 3 minutes.
Ugh.
It was beautiful, and I felt his pain. And I think what I really enjoyed is that he adds like this, he's a jazz musician, so I appreciate his jazz influence. You know, there was just touches of a great jazz piano or a trumpet or bass that I really enjoy musically in his interpretations of Bill Withers. But at the same time, his voice has such a similarity to Bill that you feel comfortable with his interpretation in that way. You know, but his voice is beautiful and has this great gravitas to it that I love. But, you know, when he starts singing Ain't No Sunshine, you're like, oh, it kind of sounds like Bill, but it's not, because of the jazz influence, I feel.
Yeah, great, great. So what is your rating? Just to remind people, we're in Star Search land now. We take turns being Ed McMahon. So we're talking about a 4-star scale. Amita, what are you going to give Jose James' album Lean On Me?
I give Jose James' Lean On Me 3.75 stars. I love it.
What is happening?
No, I do.
On behalf of Jose James,
I do. Thank you.
Yeah. I love it. Love that you love that. Thank you. Let's keep the good vibes rolling. What do you have to big sell to me this week?
Okay, well, I'm very excited to share my big sell this week, because if anybody listens to this podcast, you know my husband in my head, the multi-talented Riz Ahmed, Emmy-winning Riz Ahmed, is also a MC and rapper and musician and extremely talented and passionate lyricist. And he came out with a new solo song, and I'm really excited to share it with you. I can't. I'm grinning. I'm giddy. I love him so much.
I love that you love Riz MC, as do I. I think you love him more, but I didn't even know he had a new song. So I'm ready.
Clearly,
I'm ready
to end this podcast now. Follow him on all his social media channels, like I do.
I do not. I rely on you.
I get Riz alerts.
Okay,
it's a Riz alert, Riz guys. Alerts. Get on it. Get on the Riz alerts.
It's a red alert. Red Riz alert. Okay, so what's the song?
It's called Mogambo. It's fiery, it's passionate, and it's he really had something to say, and I just want you to experience my man.
In your head.
And let me know what you think.
I am all about that, so bring it. We're going to put that in the show notes so that all of you guys can experience it along with me. And yeah, we'll be back in the next episode to share the review. So thanks for that big sell, Amita. That is it for now, people. We thank you very much for coming back week after week to listen to our conversations about pop culture. But please stay in touch with us throughout the week on Twitter and Instagram. You can find us at Pop Insiders. We tweet, we post pictures, we do what we do on the show, but on social media.
You can find us everywhere you find podcasts. You can find us also on a pretty cool podcast network called Maximum Fun. Go head over to MaximumFun.org and listen to us and a lot of other podcasts dedicated to comedy and culture. Thanks for listening, guys.
Ernest Hemingway once wrote, "The world is a fine place and worth fighting for." I agree with the second part.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.